just your name.
I'm Nerida.
Yes.
Nerida Waters.
Excellent.
Yep.
I haven't met you before, Nerida.
I haven't met you, but you're friends with Zaman, did you?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I was talking to Zaman and Lizzie the day before yesterday.
Are you? You're not from up here, obviously.
No.
Where are you?
I grew up in Darwin.
Okay.
And then I ended up in Melbourne to study at VCA, and then ended up in Sydney working.
And you're doing podcasts.
Right now, yeah.
This is
one of the many things, huh? We're all doing many things.
That's right, yeah.
Nice segue.
Yeah, okay, good, excellent.
Do you want to tell me about hairy one of the many things that you're doing that you're,
you're
interrogating and that frustrates you but it keeps you alive?
Okay, I'm one of those yes people who say yes to everything, which is good. I think it's a fear of missing out.
Yes.
Maybe deep inside where you go, I want to be part of everything.
Yeah,
I would get jealous.
I heard a story, a lady that said no, and then it turned out the thing she said no to was this pilot program that turned into
something fantastic. Isn't there a story of the fifth Beatle, the person who had a chance to be one of the Beatles and said no, and then went, oh, damn, I should have probably said yes to that one. That would have, that's right. So that's probably fear in the back of my head.
There was Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, and there was a third engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And when they floated the company, he could have kept his share or he could have just taken the payout.
Yeah, right.
And if he kept his share and everything went sour, then he would have been in debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But as it turns out, now he didn't make tens of millions of dollars.
Ridiculous.
We don't have to worry about that.
Ridiculous. At the moment, I'm about to go on tour tomorrow.
Yeah.
For 3 months with a children's show called Tashi. It goes around Australia. But I've just finished a show up in Toowoomba, which was in the days of APAM. We had to do two kids' shows a day and then drive 2.5 hours each way back down to APAM at night to showcase. I had regrets at the beginning of going, why have I said yes to everything? How is this going to be possible? Why am I taking advantage of being in Brisbane at APAM when it's here and we're showcasing a show and I can't actually have chats about it because I've said yes to other things? And I always have that thing of needing to save other people's problems as well. They needed someone to do it and went, oh, I've got to save their ass.
Yes.
And then, sabotage myself. And, you know, but in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, if I get another actor to play that part, then if that gets opportunities, then I'm handing over that potential opportunity, which has happened in the past. So.
Yeah.
But it was a really fantastic and enjoyable experience up in Toowoomba. So that was positive. And the person I was working with, I haven't had a chance to work with before. So that was a really positive thing.
Cool.
But, yeah, it was the week from hell. And my car broke down, so I had to get a hire car. So I actually paid to do the gig up in Toowoomba. Yeah.
Well,
pretty much.
Good story,
and then what else? Oh, so we were presenting a show called Boy Go War, which is with my company, The Escapists.
And you're quite a leading force in that.
So it's me, my husband's. I suppose because we're a married couple, there's six of us in the company.
Yeah.
But because we're a pair, it feels like we do. We're pretty much doing all the work because the majority of the decision making is together at the same the two of us are together at the same time.
Yeah.
So, and it's Lucas's one man show, and I'm the orchestra pit and play all the dinky instruments on the side,
cool.
the sound effects. My point was that I suppose we're kind of like the decision makers because Lucas has to actually be the person on stage to the face of it, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Is that a vehicle for your visions or your concepts, or you have also another thing?
Definitely. Okay. So it's a collective, the group.
Yeah.
Under this collective, we make certain types of work.
Okay.
That is, I suppose, usually comic-based, story-based, storytelling-based, and whimsical, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then I have other desires to make other kinds of work that don't necessarily fit into that category.
And is that category shaped by audience or by presenters or by funding?
It's shaped by, the combination, the recipe the people in the group.
Okay.
Not necessarily individuals, but by how we see ourselves together
as a group.
Yeah. And also by the shows that we've made then have a certain reputation where you feel like, oh, people expect this kind of work from this product. Yeah. So maybe if we do a Rocker Steadford right now, it, you know, even though that's our desire, going, okay, let's do a, you know, stupid big spectacular, it may not be the right thing for this company to do, so let's do
and
it.
So you just do it under a different name.
That's right. Yeah, or under a different, I work with lots of different collectives of people, so sometimes it's a couple of the escapists and other people.
Yeah.
So you go, well, can't really call it an escapist show if it's got another company involved, so we just go as individuals.
And is that just about keeping busy then, or is that also about getting the resources that you need?
I think it's about satisfying your other interests. I studied as an actor, but when I graduated from acting course, I went, oh, I'm actually really interested in the movement side of storytelling and movement side of theatre.
Mm-hmm.
So I have been employed a lot as a choreographer and being an outside eye for directing shows in a blocking choreographic kind of way, even though I'm kind of a bullshit artist. Like, I've never actually studied or I never trained as a choreographer. And when I first moved up to Brisbane,
it's more in the eye than it is anything else.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah,
you need to choreograph.
I feel like a professional bullshit artist is kind of
your title. That's your working title.
Yeah, the way I see myself when people ask what I do. Like I was in a group called a show called Tarnished, which was four showgirls putting on a show, and I was the clown of the show, pretty much. And I was called the little shit.
Okay.
And everyone else, all the other artists in the group, were really precious about how they were titled. The queen of burlesque and blah, blah, blah. And I spent, and can you just write for me? And some little shit, Nerida Waters, who's a professional bullshit artist. And that's all I want to put. I don't want to put any other. I don't like wanking on myself, which kind of sabotages yourself sometimes when you go, actually, I should say, I should, you know, because people just see you then, oh, you're just an idiot. Oh, actually, I'm a professional idiot.
Because you're a professional
idiot. I'm actually, I've studied really hard to be this fucked.
But then it's just a question about validity.
Yeah.
If art is completely valid in the society in which you're working, then you can say that you're a bullshit artist.
Yeah.
Because nobody's questioning whether that art needs to be made or needs to be funded.
Yeah.
But then the self-deprecation comes when you're in a society or a culture that doesn't take it as a necessity.
That's right.
And so you feel like, well, you may be able to do whatever you need to do on stage. Actually, the booklet or the flyers or all of these things need to be constantly reinstating the professional world-class validity and need for this cultural export.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But it should all be art.
Yeah, exactly.
At whatever level.
And I face this a lot with comedy is a big part of the work that I make.
Comedy scares the
and
shit
it
out of me.
It gets looked down at a lot by funding bodies and, you know, high art kind of society. And I think
they don't like to laugh.
Yeah, and I also get the shits with that of people not seeing the skill in that and going, oh, you just made people laugh, but the other people that were in the show did these incredible circus tricks or blah, blah, blah. And I went, I think it's
really hard to make
really,
people laugh on cue.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people who can climb a tissue or climb that thing. It's just working on your muscles. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not
and fear and dexterity.
Oh, yeah, a whole lot of other stuff as well. But it.
But you could do it whether the audience is there or not.
Yeah.
When it's things like this.
Yeah.
And I say that as a dancer. I know that I could do a kick-ass rendition or execution of a solo if there's an audience there or not. But if I'm trying to make people laugh and be funny, that has to happen between this person and then the people that are observing or experiencing it. It can't happen by itself.
Yeah. And it doesn't happen every night. And it can't. The joke or the trick that you're doing as a clown or comedian has to change constantly because
people acclimatize.
Yeah, or the joke gets stale or it's just
or something.
It's an untangible thing.
It's precious.
That's right.
It's an untouchable subject for a week or a month.
Yeah, it's got to be constantly, I don't know the right word, but liquid, like, I suppose.
Do you get three tries? Like in backflips or b-boy moves or whatever, do you get three tries?
Oh, in with jokes.
Yeah, if it doesn't work.
Well, to a certain degree, you know, I think.
What's your fail say? Someone told me the other day, if you joke shit, just call it out.
That's definitely being honest to an audience.
Okay.
I had to, do you know the Helpman Awards?
Yeah.
So this woman won the Helpman Award in the show that was coming up to Brisbane.
Mm.
The night on Monday night, the show came to Brisbane, and I got a call the next day saying, "Oh, she's sick. Can you come and learn the show?"
Yeah, right.
And I went, "Yes," because I'm a yes person, hung up the phone and literally shat myself, like ran to the toilet, lost it, went, "Oh my God, I'm so nervous.
That's
what have I done?"
Flight or fight
response.
Yeah, evacuate.
And arrived when I had 4 hours to learn the show.
The Helpman Award winning performance.
Exactly. Yeah. Expectation. There was something, 12 different characters this girl was playing, unicorns, bitchy girls, ridiculous amounts of costume changes. And
the costumes fit you?
No, because I'm short. Okay. They all dangled off me. So unicorn was a Shetland pony version of a unicorn.
Right, excellent.
And
excellent.
Had script in hand, so I had to turn... Couldn't turn pages.
Because you had a
hook. I had hook hands. And then in my mind, I was just like, if you're just honest with the audience, they're going to be on your side. Mm. So I laughed.
Yeah.
Just pissed myself laughing. Went, I can't turn the pages. Then the audience laughed.
Okay.
And then I went, okay, I'm going to use the audience. And went, asked one of the audience in the front row to turn the pages for me, yell them out. So then they got involved with the whole, they got informed at the very beginning of going, look, this woman's just been flown to, rushed to hospital. Nerida's stepping in to save the day. I went, okay, cool. As long as everyone's in on the honesty of it, they're going to have a really good time. And a few times I ran on stage accidentally at the wrong time. I went, I'm sorry, it's not my part, is it? And then the audience cracked up. So I went, okay, cool, I'm just going to play the idiot, because I'm feeling like an idiot.
Yeah.
So I will open my heart and emotion to letting the audience be seeing the play through my eyes, because so they were going, oh, my God, that girl is coming on the wrong wigs and, sorry,
No,
I was just thinking of that. I think with comedy, you do that if you expose your vulnerabilities, and that can be funny, but sometimes it can be awful, and the audience just go, no, we're not on your side, and you're showing you too much.
And then what do you do?
You die on stage. Yeah, you fail, and I think every person who's done comedy has had really, really awful experiences.
And do you just... So do you just turn and walk off?
Yeah. You finish and you go home and you go, okay, quickly get in the car.
You've got a list of things.
You just and then sometimes you can use that material for the right audience.
Yeah.
To tell them the whole story of the worst experience possible, and then that can be really funny for an audience. So, and different people, different cultures find everything. Of comedy have different opinions about what's funny. You know, comedy's very specific, and I think that's why comedy's funny, because it's tailor-made for specific types of people. Mm-hmm. If it was general, then it's really not funny. It's
true. Because, you know instantly whether it's worked.
Exactly. You can feel it even before, but you can feel whether the audience are with you or not. And that's what I love about doing comedies is it's, you have to be there in the moment. It's happening right now, and you know exactly how the audience are feeling immediately.
Mm-hmm.
There's no kind of, experience when you're doing a drama or imagine with dance, I'm sure you would feel it as well, where the audience are
sometimes,
into it.
Sometimes you just wreck.
Don't know. You finish and you're going, I don't know how, what.
Yeah. Well, sometimes the fourth wall is really strong in a lot of dance. And I think that can be a downfall for sure.
Yep.
Because a lot of the dance that is currently very engaging doesn't have that fourth wall.
Yeah.
But you might not know how a show has gone until it's in a magazine too much.
Yeah,
later.
In a review or.
Yeah. And even then you read it and you go, nah, that's bullshit.
Yeah. You don't know.
And so you don't know. Especially if you're making it and you're in it.
Yeah.
Then...
to only be colleagues and opinions from...
Yeah. And I feel that comedy, maybe the technique isn't universal, but the need to laugh with others.
Yeah.
And the acclimatization that happens through an upbringing is that that's possible. Whereas the eye that you need to be able to appreciate something that's more abstracted, that if you haven't been given that, like I don't know the rules to football, I know to soccer, but I don't know the rules to football. So even when I'm watching it with other people, I don't have the same reaction.
Yeah.
And when they get smacked into by like these big dudes and they smack into another big dude, I don't have the physical response because I don't have the experience of getting smacked into.
Yes, yes. Well, imagine that would be like circus and dance as well. Exactly. If general public come and see it,
they
go, oh, yep. But if you've actually...
if you've tried
even it. Just done classes and you are more educated about, okay, what that... how hard that actual kick really is or pirouette really is, you have a respect for it and go, oh, that's thrilling because I can understand the commitment and the training and the effort that goes into all of that craft and... and that's the thing with comedy as well. I think, you know, you see fantastic comedians and storytellers being able to adapt and change to a specific audience. And, you know, if they're not laughing at the particular jokes that they're used to saying, it's a real craft to be able to get that audience and go, okay, we're going to go on a different ride and so spontaneously on the spot. You know, you go far out. That's incredible.
So you need to have mountains of material.
Mountains of material. And
endless.
And, yeah, I have a friend who's... I don't know if you saw Mario, Queen of the Balls. He was at World Theatre Festival. He's one of the world famous juggler, dressed up as Queen, and has been on the street, you know, for most of his life, perform their shows. But you just see him working with an audience is incredible. Like he can, because he's had the experience of the most yobbo crowds on the street, and you know, most varied humans.
Paid, they're not invested.
That's right, and he's really got to. That's how he earns his living. So you go, well, you're well. That you see the craft in that, and it's incredible.
The experience. So how do you? I wonder. We're talking about the highs and the lows.
Yeah.
But now I'm wondering about the living with it. Like, you have this thing that is a huge part of yourself and it nourishes as much as it strains.
Yeah.
But you, like, there's it and there is the self and they have to live together.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
I know for dance that you get massive post-performance season lows just because chemically the endorphins
are
drifting away,
and
the group, you suddenly go from being around 10 people and being needed to no one.
So how do I deal with that, or what's my experience of it?
I don't know.
Well, I suppose that's why I'm a yes person, saying yes to everything. Lucas and I, my husband, we definitely go through those periods where even when you think you're going to be employed, then suddenly the project falls through due to funding or some other reason. Yeah. You go, damn, I've blocked out those 2 months of that year and I've said no to other things. Yeah. Have massive regret, and then you're going through financial problems. Go, what am I going to do? I have to go speak to a friend who works at a hotel, you know, a hospitality, or ask for a shift that I can easily drop when I want. So you go through, and I think everyone to a certain, I think everyone goes through that experience of what you do. You validates yourself and purpose and reason for living on this earth. So when you feel like you've got no purpose, it is that you go, what the hell am I doing with my life? And even having those conversations every day, people bumping into you and go, hey, what are you up to? And you go, nothing. I'm up to this week I've done the washing, went and saw a movie, I slept in, had a 3-hour bath, and it can be really depressing.
But whereas I think if you know that you had a 50-week-a-year job and that was your 2 weeks off.
Oh, you'd be loving it. It'd be amazing. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's my favourite period of time when you've got, say, two, 3 weeks or even a month off, but you've got really clear work starting straight off that month.
Yeah, right.
You go, oh, my gosh, I'm going to go up to, you know, Noosa, stay on the, you know, be on the beach all day and not worry and, you know. But it's that anxiety of when's the next work coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I definitely say yes to a lot of things to constantly keep myself busy. And Lucas and I, we create our own work as well as being actors that perform in other people's shows. Because I think when I graduated from uni, I was just an actor and living in Sydney, and would just go for bit parts on water rats and get rejected and go, I don't even like water rats. Why am I getting so upset about being rejected? Yeah. And going, oh, I,
it doesn't matter
my
what
life,
you're rejected
I have no power over my life.
Even if you don't want to go into a strip club and you walk too close to the door and the bouncer says, no, excuse me, sorry, you can't come in.
Yeah.
And then part of you gets really offended that you've been rejected from something you never wanted.
Exactly, exactly.
I don't know what that's about.
It's just wanting to be accepted everywhere, isn't it? Like, I had the same thing of lining up at a nightclub when it first opened here. It was a really cheesy, apparently nightclub, but they wouldn't let me in.
Yeah, right.
And I looked very nerdy, I suppose. I had a kilt on and, you know, it looked really like I was going to Sunday school.
Okay.
I suppose.
Some people like that.
And the man said, oh, you look too casual. And I went, that's the wrong thing to say to me, because I'm in, like, patent leather shoes and a skirt that comes up to my knee, and the girl in front of me has cut-off jean shorts with her ass hanging out. It's not that I look too casual. It's that I don't look like I'm here to pick up. Mm. If you said the right thing, I'd be less offended.
Yeah,
but
right.
I'm in my fanciest shoes like, that I own. And the woman in front of me is wearing a thong hanging out of her, you know, like. I just don't look like I'm ready to be a slut tonight. Yeah, I think was the correct thing.
Yeah.
But I did feel rejected.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Do you, being with somebody who you work with and who also has this up and down of cash and purpose, do you guys end up having money arguments that are stupid?
No, because when we got married about 6-7 years ago, Lucas is a big spender and loves comic books and is very loose with his money. He's a massive collector.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to suppress that or feel bad about that. Mm. So we just went, let's just have separate bank accounts and do your own thing. You know, and of course with, you know, bills and going out and doing stuff together,
yeah, yeah.
We do, you know, we just pay, you
each
know.
Each other's way.
Each other's way. But when it comes to being in control of your money, you do what you want with it. Mm-hmm. I do, and then I think that has been fantastic, because just hearing about other people's relationships with shared bank accounts and things, and them having little fights over, oh, what have you spent here? And I didn't want to go into that, because I knew that we had different ways of. I don't like things, and I earn a lot. I earn a lot less, and I spend a lot less. So I like. I don't
need them.
I don't want to be comparing how much he's buying for himself and I'm not. Yeah. So I went, good, it's been really a good decision, I think. Even though it sounds weird not having a shared bank account, but it's, I think it's been a positive thing for us.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Definitely share things like cars and hospital bill, you know, any of those kind of things, you know. You know, help Lucas out with that, but he's not good with his money in regards. Yeah, I'm like one of those. I think I'm like the mafia. When shit goes down, I pay for it.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, and he pays for treats every day.
Yeah, the adventurous stuff.
That's right. The fun. Right. And he buys me lots of presents, buys himself lots of presents.
Yeah, right.
I'll pay his emergency hospital bills. And a documentary about The Voice. And where it comes from,
I've
accents.
I've read his book, but I don't think I
can't remember what that is. A 3-part doco. And it looks at Tourette's, looks at babies when they first start speaking, where accents come from, where they're influenced by, and all around the world. It's incredible. It's really good.
So have you had to perform for audiences that are non-Australian speakers and speak another English, and then do you change your accent for them?
Well, we went over to the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And Belgium, we did 43 shows over there, but it was mostly a physical show. It wasn't very spoken.
Okay.
Yeah. So we didn't really.
You didn't take out all your joining words or anything?
No, we didn't have to really speak. But it was a comic kind of showgirl show, and the sense of humour didn't translate over there. It was really interesting. We didn't realise how Australian our show was until we went over there.
The Belgians are not down.
Well, Belgians were okay. It was more the Netherlands. they don't really celebrate the underdog. Like, and that was our show. It was four showgirls putting on a show and showing all the mistakes, like this 6 foot tall burlesque star falls flat on her face. Uh-huh. And the audience over there just went, she's made a mistake. And in Australia, they pissed themselves laughing. They love taking down the most amazing looking, you know, high status character. And and they were all 6 foot something tall girls and a me on a pair of stilts.
Okay.
And over there they were going, oh no, why didn't they just get a four?
Another tall girl.
Another tall girl.
I didn't see that. Okay.
And in...
So the castle wouldn't work over there.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we had recorded all these sound problems in the show. So, and then we speak into a hairbrush because the microphone is not working. And then they wrote a review over there saying, oh, and then the sound conked out. Oh, so amateurish. She went, no, that's... the joke.
Yeah,
like, they don't understand that sense of humour. And wow, that's so Australian. We love bringing back down the tall poppy and taking the piss out of the person
of
on
course,
top, you know.
Tree.
And I think that only really translates in England and Australia. That's a very English, British sense of humour, isn't it? And showing the flaws and showing the warts and all, and we laugh at that. Whereas other cultures go, why show the flaws? Just be the best. And they have this, you know, Marcel Marceau is their clown, not the idiot, you know.
Yes.
So it's really, that was really interesting to learn over there. And scary and, like, painful as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is hilarious.
This is hilarious. We've got all these awards in Australia. We're toured. We got sold out. We're amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't love us like they do back. It was good. It's a really good experience. So, and comedians talk about that all the time, having to change their whole show to different audiences. And
so say, for example, if you wanted to win a certain award, you want like the Edinburgh Comedy Festival Award versus the Melbourne Comedy Festival Award, because one is held in higher esteem than the other, depending on the circles you're in.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to win one, then you would have to tailor your show specific for them.
Potentially.
And that award-winning show might not
translate.
Be good at all.
Mm. I reckon that it's definitely true. I think it would be the same with dance as well, hey? Like, I mean, people would still generally really appreciate everything at a certain skill level, going, okay, those people are professional.
Maybe
it
used to be more so, but YouTube has changed that.
Mm-hmm.
Because now if you... And there's still... It's really built into dance to still try and be the best.
Mm-hmm.
Not in all dance, for sure, but the dance that I'm most familiar with is ballroom dance and break dance or b-boying. And contemporary dance, and those are very world dances now, Western world, but still, I did a research lab a few years ago at Ultima Vez, and Vim was saying that he auditions people now, and they look so much more similar than they did 10 or 15 years ago when he was auditioning people, just because everyone's got access to everything.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's interesting, because if you...
So they're more eclectic... influenced, would you say?
Well,
or
I would say they will, like, it merges, what's the word? You know how they say that you should be as adaptable and broadly skilled as possible?
Yeah.
Possibly that ends up being very boring.
Yeah.
Especially if you, in
it
your work,
that specificity,
you want to make something about the individuals, and
it
has to be specific to that group of people performing something for this group of people to watch, experience, and undertake. Or invest in, then
it's like culture's dying, and
culture is dying,
which is really scary. And everyone's
employable,
then
culture is dying,
And
why wouldn't, as a young dancer, you want to be as employable as possible and learn?
It's diverse. Like,
go on YouTube, to be diverse. Yeah. Learn all the repertoire from these huge named companies and then go on audition for them, with the old school understanding that being able to do their stuff would make you employable by them and interesting to them.
Yeah.
And then turns out, actually, they've got that.
Yeah. They're looking for something.
They're looking for something else.
I know. That's a scary and sad thing about all language, everything, culture, you know, everyone having... I think in Cuba, I saw a documentary where... They're a communist country, and it's just being opened up to America being able to import things.
Mm-hmm.
And Cuba's this beautiful, untouched place. Feels like it's set in the 50s, and
yeah, right.
Beautiful old you know, car, old 50s mm-hmm. cars driving mm-hmm. around. And
but American cars.
Yeah.
Like the sanction began but in the 50s.
But it stopped the import-export.
Yeah. So maybe it's more like 50s America
but, yeah.
than 50s Cuba.
Yeah. But it's now that the people who live there are going, fuck, we want to import stuff. We don't want this. We've got buildings that are falling down. Yeah, they're unsafe. And tourists go there and go, oh, no, it needs to be untouched. We want to save this. But the people who are living there are going, no, give us mobile file. We're sick of this, you know. So it's a really weird catch-22 in the like of trying to preserve cultures, but at the same stage, making those cultures being able to have access to the other things as well, like advance them.
Yeah. Well, someone, I forget, I think it was written in a book, which I can't reference at the moment, but a character was talking to another character and said, now, don't make the mistake of thinking just because Japan is technologically advanced that it hasn't been westernized.
Yeah.
Because it is still very much Japan and has Japanese cultures, and those cultures have become technologically advanced.
Yes.
And that's different.
Yeah.
But it just looks more similar.
Yeah. Okay.
And who knows if that's true. It's just what the book said. But
mm.
gives me hope.
Yeah.
And then...
And all of us traveling around so much, like it's just like public transport. You're going, I'd be really sad if everything just... I was very upset the first time I traveled. Where did I go? Just over to Europe. But it's going, oh, it feels... It felt less foreign than what I expected, I think. I suppose mainly in big cities.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went, oh, I thought it was getting... I think when I first went to London, I thought it was going to feel... a hell of a lot more foreign than what feels a bit way too familiar for my liking.
I think it's I would propose that it's either in the country, in the bush, or in the people.
Yeah.
And someone, a colleague I've worked with, Timol, he was saying that he lived in the States for 4 or 5 years and that it took him nearly half a year to notice how different the States was to Australia. They're both Western countries, they're both post-colonial countries. And they're both functioning Western democratic capitalist
markets. When you see in the detail.
But then how people respond and react and what they hold dear.
It's very different.
That becomes very different. Mm. Like the British hand-me-down of saying sorry to everyone you bump into to avoid getting in a fight.
Yeah.
Whereas in Germany, it's just a part of life. You're going to get knocked into.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. And...
We just came back from America. Uh-huh. I realized every time I approach someone, I say, excuse me, sorry. Yeah. And when I was over in America, when I started that sentence, they went, what? Just said, what? Really great. I went, oh, you guys are so aggressive and scary. But they're used to being really direct. So if they need something, just go in, where's my bag?
Yeah, right.
And people, the Americans respond really well to that. I hear them talk to them. They went, just over here.
And so it's
and
clear.
And this is clear. And I mean, oh, that lady was so rude asking for a bag. Where I was like, oh, excuse me, sorry, I don't mean to disturb you, but I was wondering, do you guys have my bag?
Yeah.
And they went, what? And if I said, so I need my bag, and I went, oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't understand that polite sentence.
When you were talking about how the teenage girls with these really broad Australian accents, but they were still softly spoken and polite, and there was this etiquette.
Yeah.
And that... not only has the accent changed now, but the etiquette has changed. And the etiquette feels more, I don't know, feels less about the listening and more about the ability to quickly respond.
Yeah, right. Potentially.
Is a proposal.
Potentially.
And also our TV all used to be British and now it's all American.
Mm. So we might be definitely having a bit of an influence up from that.
When I imagine when 2 or 3... generations ago when kids were playing cops and robbers, they would have accents from The Bill.
Sure.
But now they have accents from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And you see 8-year-olds with a stick that they're using as a gun, and the words that are yelling out, like freeze, stop, don't shoot, put your hands up, they're all in the accents of the films that they've heard them in, not in their own accents.
I think so. I think it could be a definite rub-off.
So what does that make us?
Sponges.
Ah, it's true. It's true. And then if you want to speak clearly, then you'll impersonate the other accents.
Yeah, definitely.
which happens even when you speak with someone who's been working in, in Europe, there's a Euro-English.
Mm.
And you learn that if you want to be understood, then you flip your sentence structure.
Right,
and
yeah.
No, she is the girlfriend of.
Right.
Say the name, yeah. Because that's their sentence structure, and you yes. know that their English is at the level that it's not. Their English actually is not spoken to other English speakers.
Yep.
Their English is spoken to other European members who are native speakers of their countries
mm-hmm.
who have learnt Euro-English.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
There's, but, you know, I don't have a lot of experience. It's just what I've noticed.
Yeah.
One question that I've been asking everyone, which doesn't even need to be answered, which is in relation to your big thing that you're grappling with and living with, this ongoing FOMO. As
yeah.
someone told me the other day.
Yeah.
This fear of missing out, but also the need to make something that'll make people laugh. And with all the effort and energy that goes into that, what's the best thing that can happen?
The best thing that can happen for me?
I don't know. That's the whole question.
It's also balance, isn't it? Like,
isn't it?
You know, if you've got too much, it can be insane. And
yeah, right. So the thing that you're asking for all the time, you can actually get too much of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One of my dreams was to make up shows, tour them with friends overseas to places you want to go. And
yeah.
I've had that opportunity to make a show, have it tour overseas, get paid fantastically. Mm-hmm.
With
and
your friends.
With my friends.
And they're still your friends.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
then come back and go, oh, it was a bit too long. It was a bit too long. Like, I'd want to, you know, it was only 2 months solid, but I wouldn't want to do that all the time.
Mm.
I'd also like to be, I like going away on tour for, say, short periods of time. From
2 weeks.
Or, you know, up to 2 months.
Okay.
But then definitely coming home and returning and having a base and
yeah.
Creating another show, creating again.
Yeah.
Whereas I have friends that have made shows and they've been touring nonstop for 2 years or 3 years.
Right.
I mean, that would feel a bit like hell to me, even though part of me, while I'm not touring,
wants
I get a bit
that.
Jealous of
yeah,
that
of
and
course.
Go, oh, that would be amazing. They're over in Berlin now.
Yeah.
Exciting. But then when I'm actually think of the logistics and all the detail of it, I go,
yeah.
Hell, constantly living in a suitcase
yeah.
and performing the same show.
The same show.
And feeling like you're not growing as a human being, going, I'm not making new stuff. I'm not learning anything
yeah.
new because I'm doing the same routine
yeah.
or the same dance for, you know, your case. I'm
yeah.
not actually
getting
to classes. I'm not, you know, reading yeah. books, you know, like I would at home, or, you know, teaching myself German or whatever, you know, or going to class, you know. I have that feeling of while I'm on tour. And you do age more, I think. From flights and exhaustion, you come back.
Audio-based medium.
Yeah. You go, oh, you come back and you go, I've got more grey hairs. Right? Yeah.
Because
it's such an exhausting thing.
Yeah.
There's pros and cons. So I think I like...
You like coming home.
Yeah.
I like coming home.
I like coming home, being home for bits. And I think Lucas is not a big fan of touring. I think he'd like to definitely have a more permanent job at home.
So does that mean that maybe you could just make and then put it on another... Get a group of people together, make it on them,
yeah.
send them off to tour, get
yeah.
another group of people, make something on them.
Definitely. You could. Yeah, I would be satisfied part of me doing that. But
okay.
then I would also go, oh, I want
to... But maybe you
I love
just
performing
have to go
well.
And visit them in certain key
Yeah, that's
cities.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
We'll
do short tours, do a show.
Yeah.
I suppose the power being more in your, you know, being in your hands when you go, oh, I feel like touring for a bit. Now I don't. I can
yeah.
say no to the bookings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
then you feel like as soon as you say no, you're not going to
It's a missed
asked.
Opportunity for me. Oh, so that balance constantly of negotiating, going,
mm-hmm.
yeah, okay,
mm-hmm.
what do I want to do now? I don't know, because it would be, you definitely have desires of going, it would be nice to have a, you know, big old house, property, you
mm-hmm.
know, but would that actually would I set that all that up and then I'd be bored shitless and go, oh no, there's no one here.
Well, you got to repaint the fence every now and again.
Exactly, that's right. Do some reading. Stuck there, and then you look on Facebook and all your friends are in Berlin doing shows, and you go, oh, I could have been doing that.
Yeah. Now I'm just mowing a lawn. Doing shows, and you're watching all your friends have babies and mow the lawn.
Sitting in hammocks on amazing properties. Yeah. Going, oh, that looks awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. So you balance of both. Balance of both.
What about for the? What about bigger? Bigger than what you need to feel nourished.
Yeah.
What is the best thing that could happen out of the effort that you're putting into the world?
What do you mean bigger than what I feel?
Yeah.
Would be better.
No, like, so with all the things that we do, it's not for financial gain.
Yep.
For some people, it's about revolution. For some people, it's about fashion. I don't know. Everyone's about something else. For some people, it's just...
What would be the ideal dream of...
Not even how it manifests, but, like, what is going to be different after the next, like, after your lifetime of effort?
Right, okay.
It's not what's the point.
Yeah.
It's not that question, but it's a little bit that question. But what is the best?
What's the overall best purpose of...
What's the best outcome? Is there an outcome?
Of everything.
Of anything.
Oh.
Hi, Ro.
You got my room key?
Yeah, it's just on the bench behind you.
I kind of don't understand the question.
No, of course, sorry. I'm leaving it open because I don't want to prescribe.
I could talk and get it wrong.
let's. It might be interesting.
Okay. Ideally, it would be really exciting. Someone was asking me if I won the lottery.
I rule. I'm wrong. It's here. Sorry.
No worries.
Just. Raw, this is Narada.
Hi. someone asked if I won the lottery, would I just retire that would be amazing. And I
and your hammock, mowing your lawn.
Yeah, and I went, oh, that would be the most depressing thing ever.
Yeah.
I need purpose, like we were talking about before. Otherwise, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know. Yeah. That might as well be dead.
Yeah. How have I earned this food that I'm about to
And eat? Other people are fine with that. Other people are self-entertaining, can, you know, sit and read and go, great, I'll just drink Chardonnay every day. I don't know.
Do you think that exists? Or do you think that's just
I don't know.
Like the people who never get the opportunity to test that.
Yeah.
Because if you go from, I don't know, 8:30 till 3 school as you're growing up, and then pretty straight out of that you get a 9 to 5 or an 8 to 6, whatever job, then the only time you ever have is your recovery day, Saturday, and then your fun day, Sunday, where you're looking into the future thinking, it's about to start again.
Yeah.
And so you never get the chance to realize that actually this thing that's being pushed on you all the time is keeping you from depression.
Yeah. Everything, I believe everything is relative, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, if you have rest all the time, it wouldn't be rest. Yeah.
It's not rest.
But you only enjoy those. You know, when you're working your ass off, you dream of going, oh, when I have time off, I'm going to start a veggie garden. I'm going to have baths. I'm going to read books.
Mm.
And then when you do have big chunks off, they're the last things you. Oh, I don't feel like doing that. I just want to do a project. Like,
mostly you're hustling, you're chasing.
That's right. So I think it's all. It's all balance and perspective, and then that's great. But if I did win lots of money, I would...
How much is that? Like 4 million?
Oh, yeah, something like... 40 million. Yeah, something like that. I would put it towards creating more work and purpose for myself, you know what I mean? So I would go, okay, let's... Like, if I get really specific, I go, okay, there's this huge old theatre in Paddington that's in like an antique market.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So I would buy it back and turn it back into a theatre, then employ all my friends' independent theatre companies to do shows there, but then also for them to do workshops and developments full-time, then generate whole new audiences by the workshops that they're doing, then make that a bit of a spread, like a disease, make that a whole hub thing that's going on. Then if I want more money, then have sister groups of those kind of theatres all around Australia and get all the independent theatre companies employed full-time to then tour around and share those works among all of the stationed
and
theatre hubs.
Would it matter?
That would be amazing. Would it matter if people came?
If audience came?
That would be amazing. That's the... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
audience
yeah, yeah.
still needs to come.
Yeah,
it's not enough that it happened.
Oh, no, that would be depressing.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it has to be only for the audience.
Because I was just thinking...
Otherwise, there's no purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the money would go into generating that audience by making them a part of it, by involving them in the shows or involving them in workshops or training, educating them about theatre. In... Far out, where were we? We went over to America to this conference called IPAY, Performing Arts Market for Youth. And Montreal was saying that they have 23 professional theatre companies just in Montreal.
In one city.
In one city, because all the kids from school go and see four theatre shows a year on buses. So they're educated about it, so then they're hungry for more.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're generating this incredible audience exposure. So that would be amazing through schools and all that stuff that it gets threaded throughout and people are in Australia they're not being an artist in Australia they're not educated
for what
understanding what live performance is
for.
Yeah,
and so our education system is based around vocational training rather than education, which is excellent. It means that we have like our sidewalks are excellently built and how buildings and now transport system and we have skilled people.
Yeah.
But that isn't necessarily education.
Culture. Yeah, there's a whole different...
I think it's a huge
so many different forms of intelligence and education and
yeah. Well, even just that it seems like it's not a spoken... It's not spoken about that, yes, you can be trained to lift this thing, put this thing here, and now you fix something.
Mm.
And that can be your job. But... Your training to complete a task is not necessarily an education.
An
education is what you think about and do with your time when your time is yours.
Yeah.
And I make that distinction between just being a dancer who is a tool for someone who says, move your arm here, move your arm here. And your training is your ability to do what they need you to do.
Yeah.
But then your education is your ability to generate within yourself a journey or perform it like it means something. Or maybe that never happens at work, and maybe your education is the way that you interact and have discussions with people outside, or you draw as a hobby, or somehow education is the need, the thirst for more education.
Yes, yeah. And education as a human being.
Yeah, exactly.
There's so much.
And wanting to, and knowing that you're not done yet.
Yeah.
That you are not yet
educated
or skilled or complete.
Mm. Yeah.
Or exposed.
Without seeing, I think I was reading an article of children seeing art, seeing theatre, and what is the purpose of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to quickly articulate that to people who are arguing, why? What's it such a waste of money? And you're going, well, it's to understand empathy.
Yes.
We tell stories to be able to relate as a human being to someone else. And you go, well, I heard your story and it made me feel a particular way.
Yeah.
And that's an education, to have feelings.
Yes.
To be able to relate to other human beings, to be able to...
And to know that you're feeling.
And empathy comes in every job, like... Not just hospitals, or it's every single job.
Yeah.
You've got to understand how to relate to other humans.
Yeah, and the most
that's
horribly
where theater
functioning
and art.
Workplaces are when it doesn't.
Yeah, they make us.
And when, and when people think that anything that you do can be done just by you.
Yeah, yeah. So.
So it's about empathy.
Yeah.
And it's training the empathy that we want to exist within our culture.
Mm. That would be awesome.
That's the best thing that can happen.
Yeah. That would be the best thing that could happen. And, well, you know, I don't know if you had the experience as a dancer, but I'm an actor to people that aren't into theatre, they'll go, oh, what have you been on, Home and Away? Or when I say stage, they go, oh, like Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, okay.
You know, something like that. Then you go, oh, no, it's a shame that our general public don't all know all the... All
yeah. But maybe... As okay, much th- I'm going to propose yeah. that...
There's a lot of shit out there as well. I'm, and I do, and no, I hate it
like,
so much
no,
as well.
It's like cable TV, most yeah. of it is shit. Yeah. Almost all of it.
Yeah.
Let's say almost all of it is shit and reruns.
Yeah, but you can easily switch the channel when you're stuck in those yeah. theatres. Oh, my God, yeah, I've never exactly. been so in so much pain.
But maybe we need to also breed a culture that you can leave.
Yeah.
And maybe then that takes down the... So what the idea that I had was mm. that there are a lot of... people doing a lot of things
yeah.
that we don't care about either.
Exactly.
And there are...
But do you think that comes from, like, in regards to the arts? You're going, well, people don't care about it because they haven't been educated about, like what we were talking before about seeing someone do a pirouette. You're going, yeah. well, I don't appreciate that because I don't understand. Yeah. I've never yeah. been educated to understand the yeah. effort and the training that's
but
gone
even,
into that.
If I'm hanging out with my brother and he tells me the... specifications on an engine that we're mm. working on together because yeah. I want to learn these skills yeah. and he has them.
Yeah.
And so it's cheaper than university. Like as Zaman said the other day, so that part of his practice is the cheapest form of going to university.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm hanging out and he's telling me this stuff and he's excited about it because he understands the follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And you're excited about live theatre because you understand the follow through of activating the empathy and how that carries on and resonates within mm. a culture and in a society. But if you don't understand the follow-through, it's like reading a spec sheet of a computer, like 4 gigahertz, 8 megabytes of RAM. What's... No, 8 gigabytes of RAM these days. But,
yeah,
you read it, you're like, oh, that number's bigger than that number. All right.
What does that mean?
But
I don't
computer
know.
People
yeah.
know and they get excited yeah. about that.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer, but I do think that empathy is universal
mm.
and it's going to make a better culture and yeah. society to live in.
Yeah.
And it would be... where else do you get that from?
Yeah.
Because...
Not from our... I mean, the way our country is going at the moment. There's
no.
In our leaders and in our education...
It's reflective
education,
of that, isn't it?
Yeah. Empathy is not a focus. And, no. not, you know... And it's really scary and sad. Hopefully it gets really bad, so then there's a flip rebellion against
yeah.
it. And, you know, definitely...
It'll keep
there
going.
Is. Yeah. Hmm.
We'll just keep making stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Telling people's stories and yeah. our stories. And cool.
And I think the more people are, you know, when you're educated about theatre, say,
mm.
You then can guess things, shows that you're potentially not going to like or like. You're
yeah.
So I think you have a higher chance of seeing things that you like. Once you know the kinds of style of theatre that you like, you go, well, I know that that's yeah. something that I probably won't rock my socks, so I'm not going yeah. to buy it.
But I think you also, I was talking about this, but you need to understand, you need to translate it
yep.
somehow
the,
because...
Yep.
The description's written for maybe an audience that isn't even you in the first place.
Mm, mm.
And then you need to translate that what you like into, is that a match for it? And a lot of the time, people might think that they like the... Like, things are described as the surface of it.
Mm.
When you go into JB Hi-Fi,
yeah.
and there, the yeah. CDs are arranged into basically the surface of how fast do the beats go.
Yeah.
And whether it's a crooning male vocal or whether it's a girl with a guitar.
Yep.
Like, these are the things that we care
categorize.
About.
Categorize.
We categorize.
Yeah.
With. But actually, what people care about the music of
yeah.
is either maybe whether it's going to... It's more like classifying music for how you're going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is music you play in your car.
Easy listening.
Yeah. Or this is music that you have with Brian Eno, music
yes.
for airports.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Called it exactly its use.
Yeah.
Rather than slightly vague electroacoustic
yes.
Experimental pop.
Yeah.
And so
cafe
it fits
beats.
Into all the,
and yeah,
these
though,
categories
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that are useless.
Yeah.
So our
yeah.
arts categories are useless.
Yeah.
Because it's not saying this show will make you cry.
Yeah.
Like, or bring a first date to this show.
Yeah.
And so there's so much translation that has to happen, and then that's an education as well.
That's right. And most of the time they get marketed completely different to,
yeah.
you know, what you experience. So I think it was down at Adelaide Festival, saw 40 shows down there. And the ones that I loved were the ones that I went, oh, I'm not interested in seeing that, but, you know, I just had this time frame. Went, whoa, that was awesome.
Yeah.
And vice versa, where you go, I really want to see that. Went, oh, that was boring as batshit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, marketing's a big thing.
Isn't it?
And a lot of times, well, you know, shows, definitely in theatre, get marketed before the show's been invented.
So, yeah, so, a year before I had that experience just recently. And it was in two publications, and a couple of months, like that was a couple of months ago. And now just recently, one of the publications is about to do little spin-off posters, and flyers, sorry. And I got an opportunity, because I've been discussing it and working with it a little bit, I got an opportunity to change it. But now it's... The shows even have different names, but it's the same show with the same people.
Yeah, right.
In different publications, just because one had a different deadline.
Odd.
It's odd. It's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm glad that we got to the bottom of empathy being the ultimate metric.
I think so. I think that's the...
Yeah.
The... I was reading an article and went, I think that's what the best reason for live performance and live art is.
Mm. I just noticed that you said for.
For?
The best reason for live performance.
Fur?
Yeah.
It's soup, like the fur.
It's a fur. No, it just means somehow we've come back to Australian.
Right.
We're not trying to be understood by anyone but us right here, right now.
You've got a detailed ear.
Yeah.
You know you're going to have to listen back to this, probably.
I'll just go straight up, no editing.
Oh, really?
No, I don't know.
I feel like I'm going to say something really inappropriate now. I won't.
Like you could.
Oh.
Do you have...
No, it's not inspired, usually.
Does that thing happen to you where... So, if you say, I'm a dancer, people say, show me a move.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh,
do you do that? Would that happen with comedy?
Oh, definitely.
And do you feel like you need to then, we're going back to education, educate about the fact that usually you have to build the context before something is even funny?
Exactly. Everything's context, isn't it?
Yeah. And you say, it involves me being on stilts and you have to imagine three tall women here.
Yeah.
Then they go, good, cool.
I think... I don't know if I've ever done this, but I think I would ask them what their profession is and ask them to perform an operation or...
Yeah, right.
So now, and see how they go with that response. If they're accountant, can you please...
If you do my taxes.
Yeah. And I think they would laugh at that because then they can relate to...
Yeah.
It's, all that thing we were talking about before, show them the position that you're in right now, throw it back in their face and see if they... laugh at that.
You also don't want to be a smart ass.
No, you can do it cheekily, you know.
You could do it cheekily because...
Right.
Maybe because you're smaller than I am.
Oh, really?
I think, no, I think this makes a difference.
Yeah.
All the time. And because you're a woman and I'm not a woman. And
I had a theory, I had a show called Nerida Waters is Dodgy. Where I...
What was your title for that show? Not Little Shit.
Oh, no, it was just because
that was the title.
That was the title of the show, so that was my title.
Okay.
It was only in development, but... It was a theory. I was sitting on a plane and started to think of all the dodgy things I'd done and went, fuck, there's lots. I might just start writing them down.
Mm-hmm.
Had lists since I was five, just, you know, bullshitting people or lies or, you know, just doing little dodgy things, you know, getting away with it. And I went, oh, it's because I'm small. You know, I used to, brothers and, you know, friends at uni go, oh, Nerida, can you flog this from the canteen? I went, I'll just go in pretending I'm heating up a meal and fill it up with stuff and... get away with it. Go, oh, hey, Nerida, how are you going? I'm good. You know, just heating up my meal.
Yeah, I'm little, don't suspect me.
Yeah, don't look like a criminal.
Do you think that's your inappropriate thing that you're going to say?
Oh, I was probably going to say something worse, but it didn't. It usually comes out in when I'm feeling uncomfortable or something, so I mustn't be feeling that uncomfortable because you usually get inspired by saying something really wrong. Yeah.
I found this plant. Someone was throwing it out.
It's a lovely succulent.
Isn't it?
And it's a good place for it because they're kind of hard to kill, I think. They survive better under neglect.
Oh, wow.
So that's why we have succulents at home.
Okay, then that brings up a whole other segue. I thought we were wrapping up.
Then you got excited about another idea.
Just the idea that some of the best art comes out of exactly what you said.
Neglect.
Well, neglect or... what's the word?
Surprise. Spontaneity. Less focus.
It's something oppression. Oppression.
Oh, yes, yeah.
The best art like comes Berlin. Out of oppression.
Yeah.
And are we going to end up with incredible art? Because
yeah. Well, I think there's been lots of talk since recent state government. I think people, you know, the upside, the positive thought that was going around was like, well, you know, maybe we'll make better art. We'll have actually a reason to make really passionate political kind of art because of our anger and we've got something to talk about. And yeah, maybe. I think definitely experiences that I've had with bad bosses or bad trainers or bad directors, the bonding that happens underneath has been quite incredible. And because you've got that one central enemy, everyone gets on really well. And you go, great. But as soon as that central enemy goes, then you find enemies amongst yourselves in a way, don't you? Or...
But do you think the living standard has to drop? Or do you think everyone can still have their three meals a day and not be worried about getting shot or taken over or need to bribe anyone and still will find the need to...
Or do you think it has to get that bad?
Well, I wonder. I would like to not.
Yeah.
Because...
I don't think it's worth it.
No, I don't think it's worth it either. Yeah. If someone said, look, you've got a really utopian lifestyle...
Yeah.
Then
you can make amazing art while in the war fields. I'm not interested.
No, I'm just going to have my gelati that comes from somewhere else.
Yeah, soy flat white. That's really amazing.
Yeah, and live that and...
Yeah. I don't think I care.
The lawn
I don't think I care about art that much. I don't think I...
It must be wrong. That must not be true.
I think there's definitely those angsty artists out there, though.
Yeah,
like
maybe that's just
you know, teachers that are, you know, Russian and Polish, being through hell, and you know, love living the depths of despair and going there and being tortured to the tortured artist.
Yeah. But there's a culture as well.
Yeah,
is it the?
And sometimes I think those people are a bit wankers as well. Those tortured artists that need to live in.
Yeah.
Really. Painful circumstances. Yes. Not all art has to, a certain type of art gets created out of that, but not all.
Yeah, and someone was saying the other day, I forget who it was, an artist. He was saying that if his art doesn't sell at the gallery, then it comes home to him, and then he has to live with all this depression art that he's made, and then he decides.
So better just painting kind of that hotel foyer art.
Yeah, like, better to make stuff
commercial that foyer live art
with if it's not going to sell.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say anything else because we'll end up on another segment.
That's right. We might open another hole.
We will. Thank you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
That's so awesome. Yeah, what a great way to meet. Now.
Yeah, I know. It's odd.
Just straight Hi. In.
Okay, straight away. Okay. Who are you?
Yeah, well, I didn't, I wanted to.
Have you been doing this a lot?
Yeah, a little bit.
For a while?
No, not for a while. I've been mainly inspired by podcasts I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to have these conversations.
So you thought, might as
well. Not everybody else can be there.
Yep.
It's a small room. Yeah.
And so you're a sound artist?
I'm making sound for Lake.
Yep.
But
you also
I also make dance.
Yep. Yeah. You can make, create, choreograph?
Yeah, both.
Yep.
Performed for many years, and then I've been making and performing and composing. And
what do you think of So You Think You Can Dance, like the influence of that over dance?
I think it's horrible.
Yeah.
It's good that people see the word dance more often.
Yes.
And there are some very good dancers that are on there, but it's not discussed enough by people that watch it that it's not about dance. The show is not about dance or the dancers.
Yeah,
it's about competition and about overwhelm and about emotional response. And very few people make a lot of money in response to that.
Mm.
And there's even the bullshit surrounding it that you have to sign away your rights to work for other people during the time that you're on So You Think. And so if it is your profession...
Yeah, you're stuffed. It's not...
Yeah. And it seems a little bit different for something like Australian Idol because the industry and infrastructure and world is there to make you a star in the way of fame and fortune.
Mm.
I don't know any dancers that are making a fortune or whose name is on the side of buildings.
Yeah.
Because that's not what dance is ultimately about.
I heard, I don't even know who, one of the judges, I just watched it for the first time the other night, and she was saying about standing out as an individual in ensemble pieces, and I went, I don't think that's right. Like, the point of ensemble, theatre trained, is to look like the one thing, or to look like whatever.
And to achieve something as a group.
And that is an incredible skill.
Huge skill.
And for someone, I remember a reviewer in an ensemble show that I did pointed out someone and went, that guy was amazing in the ensemble, and the rest of the ensemble should, you know, look at that dude. And I went, can you hear what you're saying?
Yeah.
We're having a trouble with that dude who's in the ensemble, who's upstaging us all and doing something else, and we're looking at him going, okay, we better do, because he just has no peripheral awareness. Ensemble is to look your ego and individuality is to be invisible in
And
that feels like the show is kind of focused on that.
And it's not at all hiding it. It says on the questionnaire when you audition, what's the saddest thing that's ever happened to you? Exactly.
I hate those moments.
Exactly.
Oh. And for the tears, so they can play their violin.
Of course,
section.
And they keep them there for all day and say, oh no, you can't go and get food because we might need you at any moment, and then they're hungry and they're tired.
Yeah, and then go, and oh, what happened to your mum?
And then they stick a camera in your face. Yeah. And I feel like dancing, anything in which you are the physical, anything in which you are the muscle, puts you within our Western old white men's society mindset of being the subordinate already.
Yeah.
And even in movies, you see it when somebody walks in to see the big boss, if it's a gangster or if it's the chief of the World Bank, he is sitting down, because when you're rich and powerful, you're not sweating.
Yeah.
You're not doing the grunt work. You're not giving your all and trying your hardest. And so it's a very, they've taken something that already makes you very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And they're just squeezing it to make cash. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
But there are some excellent dancers who I personally know that are in the top 20.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are men.
Yeah.
And so it works for me that boys are going to see these men
dance. That's what I think the positive thing is.
And be incredible.
Yeah. It's the inspiration of going, okay, especially in Australian society, okay, it doesn't have to be about dance, it doesn't have to be about girls and looking pretty.
Or it doesn't have to be about
a particular style.
Any particular style.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it
celebrates
doesn't,
the individual.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like writing press, whatever gets them in.
Yep.
To then be educated. Mm. Or to then be exposed, I think.
That's the other thing with dancers and theatre people, where you go, your art is you.
Mm.
So mentally it can be really sabotaging, because it's not like you're a painter where you have a body of work that's recorded and they go, there's my body of work, and it's separate from me. And if you criticise that, it's still painful, but I think it's in a different way to when you're the actor, the dancer.
Yeah.
It's actually... my instrument is unfortunately, that's another whole thing.
But it's just there's a physical stress on the body when you are trying to take on new neurological pathways.
Yep.
And we've been through evolution. The study that I was reading, biologically, that can't be bothered mentality is there to save us energy so that we don't have to hunt and eat more food.
Right.
And so when we're fighting that, as well as training ourselves, as well as pushing yourself hard, then that's a different thing than doing the thing that you do.
Yeah.
Stopping, smoking, drinking wine, talking shit to people, doing some more of the thing that you do, which as a composer I can do because I'll make it and then it will be recorded and sent out. I don't have to perform, because performing is a different thing again.
Yeah.
But then I see crossovers between, say, the physical labor my dad does in his business and dance, is that somebody's paying you to slowly but still very surely destroy your body.
Yeah.
And it's no different than being the tires on a truck.
Yeah.
The tires get worn out real quickly,
and
the director, who's the engine or the driver or whatever, swaps out the tires and keeps going.
Yeah. So you've got
So what do? You want to be able to relinquish your need for self-preservation in order to make the work that will activate the empathy within the viewers. Because in some ways you're the explorer and you've got the time and the resources and the education and the skills to explore something that not everybody does have those things to do. And then you bring it back and you deliver it and you say, look, I know you all couldn't come with me, but this is what I found. Smell this, taste this, hear this, feel this. And hopefully that's our contribution.
End of the day, you've got to enjoy it then.
End
of the day, it's got to go, rock, this is making... I rock on this. On this, what I'm doing. It excites me so.
But wouldn't it bring so much more validation to a show like So You Think You Can Dance if the judges couldn't sit down and behind a bench of safety, and tell them. Tell them from that position of power, that throne position of power.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be such a leveling if there were judges for styles and the judge for the b-boying, for example, like everybody judges everybody, but the judge for the b-boying walks out on stage with the b-boys and demonstrates and responds and gives critique physically.
Yeah.
And somehow not only then validates that they can do it, because that's not the most important thing, validates that they understand it.
Yeah. So do you think, you know, how the choreographers, when they have to choreograph on the bits, with if they were, say, the judges, because if they're working with them?
No, it's tricky again then, isn't it? Yeah. Because if you are currently a practicing artist, it's very hard. It's almost impossible to not then have an agenda.
Yeah.
Somehow you need to have satisfied your need for what you need to create aesthetically and conceptually, and then have those skills left over to be able to contribute them back into somebody else's vision without holding on to the agenda that got you there in the first place. And it can't, maybe it comes back to what we were talking about before, that I think shows like The Voice or like Idol, that we were talking about the Beatles, there's no way the Beatles would have won those shows.
But
they changed the world. And they did that because they had something of value, and then they had a shitload of cash and resources behind making sure that was broadcasted. But whatever they had was not about, what was the word used before, like diversity of ability and skill and being able to adapt. It was because they had what they had.
Yeah.
And the world at the time needed it or wanted it. And so when you go on a show like So You Think, then you are trying to be the everything. But actually the world would be richer if people were just their thing and they understood and cared about and invested and had time to listen to everybody else's thing that they were and wanted to understand, but not necessarily needed to be. Maybe I'm wrong about all of that.
Yeah, that sounds...
Sounds exciting. If
possible.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exciting. Yeah.
Look, sorry, this taken.
That was me. I opened up that. I was like, I want to know as a dancer.
Yeah, of course.
How you feel about that. And I do a bit of choreography with things, but the pros about it is just for me, seeing boys having young boys having idols of going, oh, that's an aspirational, and dance to GP people now can talk a bit about styles, or that must be a bit exciting, that education to the general public. That's I wonder if audiences have increased for dance in general because of So You Think You Can Dance but maybe not.
Who knows? I do know that when I choreographed for theatre, I did a show for... I was the choreographer for a show called War Crimes that happened in Melbourne many years ago.
Yeah.
And toured a bunch of schools. And I felt very much like the sound effects or Foley artist on a film, where what I had to do was know and extrapolate everything that would naturally happen and then put it in there.
Okay.
So I saw this excellent Foley rendition, and it was from the movie Ants.
Mm-hmm.
And this dude had a thing that was about twice as wide as a milk crate each way, and it was square. And it was just, you know, those twisting coat hanger lines that
mm-hmm.
Clothes hanging lines you get from the $2 stores. A bunch of those rigged up looked like an abacus, but a little cylinder of wood in each one, like a round peg. And on one side, it was all just naked wood, and on the other side, it was all rubber, like ends, like thimble ends, but just rubber. And so when the ants were walking on dirt, he would roll it, so it went on the wood. And then when they were walking on grass, he would flip it and roll it on the rubber bits.
Wow.
And you say, of course, because that movie is based in a... You can't record the sound of a bunch of ants marching.
So he had to imagine
it and then give it to us in a way that rang true. And I feel very much that way when I'm creating choreography for theatre.
Yeah.
That you need to be able to say all the gaps that are in the script.
Yeah.
And that person needs to say one line, and this person may or may not look at them. I still feel like the looks and things like that are based on the performer and the director. But then maybe the choreographer's job is just to get them to sit down or do something, maybe make it surreal in that they respond with something that isn't, that would be normal, except at some point somehow you've turned the volume up on it and then it becomes like those Gregory Crudson photos where it's not a photo of real life, it's a photo of something
something's
constructed.
Amped and something, there's a subversion, there's a perspective,
but what that perspective is
brings more true than what the actual naturalistic
it somehow turns the volume up on our experience and our activation of empathy. Because I think I was talking to someone about this, that there's this theory that a long time ago, I don't know how long ago, I guess before writing, that perhaps populations were telepathic or to an extent they could sense what was going on within their population. And we lost that over time as the world got noisier through tools and industrial revolution and spreading of populations. And now we're getting that back. But still it's mediated through devices. So we're getting it back through telecommunications. Mm-hmm. And to somebody who didn't know from 300 years ago, the fact that I had a silent communication from you 10 minutes before you got here saying I'll be 10 minutes late is telepathy.
Yeah.
And when we reach the point that there's not a device in our hand giving that message to our brain, our brain through our eyes, we reach the point that we can get and receive those signals, then we'll just have gone back to where we were. But because we turned the volume up on everything else, we had to turn the volume up on our understanding and connection with each other as well. And we're just using electricity as a crutch.
Yep, definitely.
Which will be fine.
Yeah.
Or not. It'll bring the civilization to its knees.
I think so. I have that fear.
Yeah, right.
I think that's an anxiety from the world moving so fast that it actually is. It's going to destroy it.
Should we end on that
note? Yeah.
Only because I see how much further it can go.
That's a dangerous place to start talking about.
Let me let you out of that little note. Let me walk you out there.
Yeah.
That was so fun.
Yeah, thanks.